creative art, Pakistani filmmakers appear to have fallen into a vicious trap. Former Pakistani Premier Imran Khan had expressed his misgivings over the growing trend of vulgarity dished out by Hollywood Bollywood, laying stress on the cinema that promotes Islamic values and teachings. He even instructed his special assistant to work on a blueprint to revive the country's film industry away from the ominous shadows of Bollywood and Hollywood. However, the juggernaut rolls on.
This is a very well understood that Imran Khan was one of the great politicians in the history of Pakistan. He's still, and no wonder he can come back and take the office. However, he's concerned about the copying Hollywood or Bollywood. It has many many meanings. We could interpret into many directions. For example, Imran Khan was against the production of the blind following of Hollywood or Bollywood, because there are some differences definitely at the national level, at the international level, which that make Pakistani audience as well as the Pakistani media quite identical as compared to the other film industries, for example Bollywood or Hollywood. They have their own standards, they have their own policies, they have their own ways and methods, and they have their own cultures and ethnic standards, maybe whatever. But that's Imran Khan's meaning, was that Pakistani film industry has to develop its own identity into this competitive profession.
More recently, a Pakistani film, Joyland, which became the country's first ever entry at the Cannes Film Festival, appeared to glorify the transgender culture, much to the chagrin of Pakistan's majority Muslim population and clergy. The controversial film has rekindled the debate over the decay of Pakistani cinema.
The partition of the Indian subcontinent in 1947, besides spawning the worst humanitarian disaster, tremendously altered the landscape of film industries in the two countries. While India lost some great talent, Pakistan had to build the industry from scratch. With a strong foundation, the Indian film industry took giant strides over the years. Pakistani cinema, on the other hand, took smaller but measured steps. Quite remarkably, though, political tensions between the two countries had a ripple effect on their respective cinemas, too.
Following the partition of British India in 1947, filmmaking in the newly founded Pakistan suffered due to a lack of equipment and talent, as most noted artists and directors moved to India. In India, big cities such as Bombay, Calcutta, and Madras emerged as cinema hubs, but Pakistan only had Lahore as the major film center. The two major studios in the city were destroyed in the post-partition riots, leaving Pakistan's film industry without proper funding or specialized infrastructure.
From the partition in the year of 1947, we can see is that there was no not any infrastructure available for Pakistan at national level to make films. So it took them 3 years to make a complete mechanism or a system to make movies. And then from 1950 all the way down to the late 70s, they made pretty good hits. You could say they were the good blockbusters. Even the neighboring countries they were following, and there have been at least 8 movies that have been made following by Pakistani cinema. The Pakistani cinema produced it, and they were remade into the Bollywood movies, at least 8, right? So till late 70s, the industry was flourishing, the people were performing, and the industry was growing. But because of the General Zia's regime, who took the power, and as an army general who brought the martial law into effect, there came a complete halt into the any production of film industry because of his so-called Islamization.
Years after the independence, there was an attempt to ban Indian films in Pakistan to help the local film industry gain foothold and flourish. It didn't happen until 1965, when the second war between the two estranged neighbors prompted then-Pakistani military general Mohammad Ayub Khan to ban Indian films. More than 40 years later, in 2005, another military ruler, General Parvez Musharraf, lifted the ban. In 2019, India accused Pakistan of orchestrating a terrorist attack in Kashmir's Pulwama, which was followed by India's surgical strike inside Pakistan. It led to the reinstatement of the ban on Indian films in Pakistan. To fill the vacuum, Pakistani filmmakers quite imprudently started copying Bollywood, even at the risk of losing their own substance.
Comparatively, Pakistan and India are in the similar situation like England and America, with the same languages. England today can never make an Indiana Jones, but England still makes a Shakespeare in Love and get recognized. So we have the same chance. We will not be able to make a Dabang 2, but we will be able to make a Shakespeare in Love in the future.
Pakistan's film industry had the purple patch in the 1960s and 70s when around 170 movies were produced annually, including color films. The number has nosedived to less than 20 a year now. Many experts attribute the downfall to the separation of East Pakistan, which later came to be known as Bangladesh, in March 1971. Bengali actors and directors were instrumental in the development of Pakistan's cinema. Apart from losing creative people and skilled technicians, the film industry in Pakistan was also deprived of a big market and production center.
The 1960s, which is widely regarded as the golden period of Pakistani cinema, recorded an impressive growth of films and film stars. During this period, the country's film industry opened up to local and international markets, reaping great dividends.
Today's filmmakers, since they're starting from scratch, they don't have any continuity with the old filmmakers, they're in a conflict. They don't know exactly what a good film these days would be in Pakistan. Should it be the old-fashioned social drama, with lots of masala and songs? Should it be just a comedy to distract people from what's happening in Pakistan? Or should it be a comment, a pointed comment on what's happening in Pakistan? So they're still searching exactly for the right formula, and it'll come.
In 1971, almost 400 cinemas functioned across the country, a quarter of them in East Pakistan. A year before, 114 films alone were produced in what later came to be known as Bangladesh. The separation of East Pakistan in 1971 dealt a heavy blow to Pakistan's flourishing film industry. It took decades for it to recover, only to fall into the Bollywood trap. The cinema industry in Bangladesh also had to start from scratch. It did well in the beginning, but faced similar hurdles as Pakistan did after the 1947 partition. Over the past five decades, it has struggled for survival, prompting Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina in March this year to allocate a special fund for the revival of the country's film industry.
First of all, the government has to allocate some financial budget, substantiating monetary support. This is the first thing. Second thing is they have to work for bringing in the latest technology into the industry, and then they have to introduce the well-qualified people, the directors and actors and whosoever takes it, the scriptwriters, the storytellers, the plot setters, whatever it takes. They have to. We have to bring in the technology, like a computer, the graphic designers, the animators. It has to be a lot to bring everything together. And then what another important thing is that there has to be competitive benefits, the remuneration for the actors, the great, the talented people, so they can come, they, instead of going abroad and performing for other places, if they have great benefits right there in their at their home ground, definitely it will make a huge difference.
Experts, however, have cautioned Bengali filmmakers not to fall into the Bollywood trap like Pakistan and risk losing its essence. For both neighbors, the mantra of success lies in charting their own journeys independent of Bollywood and Hollywood.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Shahid Khan, senior investigative journalist and documentary producer from London, UK. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Khan. Now, let's begin with why has Pakistan's film industry failed to live up to its potential despite its artistic talent, intelligence audience, and ample resources?
It's a huge historical perspective behind that. In fact, Pakistan. Film industry. My elder brothers were involved in film industry. I know very well. I know those directors, those who were well renowned as well, and they made some remarkable films as well. One, apart from my brother and his colleagues, I know one known as Zia Sarhadi. He was born in India but settled in Pakistan. Then later he had to leave Pakistan because of his talent. In fact, his write-ups and his films as well. Because of the martial law and dictators and all that. So similar story are like, for example, those who survived within Pakistan, they made some good film, feature film, but not very politically. If you touch political topics, then it's a problem. That's a basic issue of Pakistan industry falling up. Also, especially, I won't go far behind, but since 80s, when Ziaulhaq, the dictator who came in power, and during his era, the worst thing happened because there was no Netflix or no digital options available at that time. Only cinemas were available. When you don't have any cinemas, or when you don't have any films coming in with the good write-ups or good direction or good actors, and the topics are not relevant to the reality, so the industry went down. And I saw many things. I spoke to many people about this topic as well, some actors and all that. The thing is, when Pakistan came into existence or partition happened, many of the writers, directors, actors of that time, they are still icons, whether Riaz Shah, or Iqbal Akhtar, whether Zia Sarhadi, or many others, actors Santosh, or you name it, so many were there. And they were making good films and they were having good attraction for Indian market at that time. Even after that, another era came up during those when the biggest screen was summed up. Then the television screen, Pakistan television dramas were of way above than even Bollywood, the Bombay film industry, and they were even copying or following the songs and also the theme and also the stories in the films. That was the aspect. I was part of the South Asian television phenomena, which we brought into Europe. And at that time, the biggest attraction was Pakistan television dramas and writers. So we had the good writers, we had the good talent, but the political scenario was against these things. And also extremism came up. Also, the Afghan jihad, so-called, came up, and the mullah fanatics came up, and they wanted to close down everything which could have changed the society. So that was a major reason behind Pakistani film industry to go down.
Sir, former Pakistani Premier Imran Khan was a vocal critic of a Bollywoodization of the Pakistani film industry, which he blamed for promoting vulgarity and immorality. Now, do you think this concerns or his concerns were legitimate?
I don't take it 100%. The thing is, to support those fanatics or those close-mindedness or those people, those who were against these phenomena, to have their support, one has to address their issues in their way. So he was addressing, whereas he was very much known as a progressive and liberal person living in Western, but his reaction was not because he wanted to have those things. Those things will never change. The thing is, vulgarity is not because of vulgarity, it's because other means, other problem, despite in Pakistan there are so many political Islamic organizations, but Pakistan society is deteriorating badly because of not having openness, not having proper knowledge or education. So they're not addressing the right issues, but these issues related with vulgarity or whatever Imran has said or he promoted, I think they were just to have the edge on political side from those people, those who are in fact controlling Pakistan, not majority, but they are controlling through establishment and all that. So it was just to promote their ideas, not to address the right issues. That's how I take it.
Last but not least, sir, what does the future hold for Lollywood and how can it reclaim its lost glory?
Well, there's no doubt that we have wonderful writers. My personal friends, I'm a journalist, I'm into media, I'm in television, my family was in film, I'm part co-producer of this film, and also I'm engaged with many of the filmmakers and directors from Lollywood and Bollywood as well, for Pakistan, India, and other places, Bangladesh as well. But I do find it's difficult, even if we can make some film like Gulmakai, we cannot show it in Pakistan. We cannot address those issues which are good for the society. We cannot address those unless they make it okay. They are this establishment, unfortunately, holding not only politics, they are holding media, they are holding every aspect. You cannot get out of those things unless they agree to you. If they agree to anything, you can do everything. If they disagree to anything which is good, you cannot do anything. So unless those controls are not fading away, we'll not be able to grow or come out of this effect of Bollywood or even westernized film concepts. We have our own local concept and topics which we can address, and we can make good dramas, good films, good everything. But we are not there because of these unwanted controls.
There you have it, Mr. Shahid Khan, senior investigative journalist and documentary producer from London, UK. Thank you for your precious time and knowledge, sir. Now let's see what people have to say on social media.
Pakistani broadcast journalist Shifa Yousafzai cites former Premier Imran Khan as saying that Bollywood movies promote vulgarity and sexual abuse in Pakistan, which are not part of the country's culture. Mehwish Hayat, a Pakistani film and TV actress, says it's time for Pakistan's cinema industry to step up and counter the way it is shown in Hollywood and Bollywood, adding that they need films about Pakistan. A Pakistani-Canadian software developer, Harris Ahmed, writes to Pakistani actor and singer Ali Zafar, expressing hope that Pakistani cinema will create its own amazing genre, away from Bollywood and Hollywood. A Twitter user by the name Gustavo stresses that Pakistani cinema is on decline, adding that copy-pasting Bollywood is not working. Ikram Hussain, a Pakistani political activist, says the country must ban Bollywood and that local artists should be given incentives so that they promote their civilization.
And that was our episode about the downfall of Pakistan's film industry due to the unhealthy influence of Indian and Western cinema. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Husseini Qumi. Stay tuned.
اقصر رأيك على ما يعنيك دنبال کارهای مفيد باش.
Imam Ali عليه السلام in his letter to Haris al-Hamdani states, confine your thinking to matters which are helpful to you. You can find this statement of Amir al-Mu'minin in letter number 69 of Nahj al-Balagha. By this phrase, Imam Ali meant to teach us how to spend our time in the way of Allah.
In name 59 Nahj al-Balagha, Hazrat.
Also in letter 59 of Nahj al-Balagha, Imam Ali alayhi salam states, know that this world is the place of trial. Whoever here wastes any hour of his time will repent it on the day of judgment. And nothing can ever make you too satisfied as not to need right. All these beautiful sentences of Imam Ali alayhi salam refer to the point that if we waste our time in this world with materialistic love, we will regret it on the day of judgment, because we are born to grow spiritually, and this world is the best place to prepare the ground for our spiritual development. Therefore, we must take care of even 1 hour of our time. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Husseini Qumi. To find out more about this program, log on to our website parstoday.com/en/Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Limelight. U.S. House leaders support for incumbent Democratic Congressman Henry Cuellar over progressive lawyer Jessica Cisneros in Texas elections have left progressives seething. We have prepared for you an article written by Joanne Grieve. The piece is titled Progressives Take Aim at U.S. Democratic Leadership over support for centrist candidates. Texas officials have still not declared a winner in the state's 28th congressional district, where incumbent Democratic Congressman Henry Cuellar currently leads progressive lawyer Jessica Cisneros by 175 votes out of roughly 45,000 ballots cast. But as progressives wait to see who will win the runoff race, they cannot help but think of what might have been if House Democratic leaders had not come to Cuellar's assistance. Henry Cuellar secured the endorsements of the top three U.S. House Democrats, and the congressman's campaign was also propped up by millions of dollars in super PAC spending aimed at attacking Jessica Cisneros. Progressives complain that House leaders' intervention in primaries like Henry Cuellar's is making it harder for their candidates to succeed, and they worry about the repercussions of the party embracing centrist candidates with controversial stances on issues like abortion rights and gun control. The potential victory of Henry Cuellar recently, who has previously received an A rating from the National Rifle Association, is all the more painful for progressives given the recent mass shooting incident at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas. The massacre, which unfolded roughly 100 miles away from Henry Cuellar's district, claimed the lives of 19 children and two teachers. Hours after the shooting last Tuesday, 24th of May, progressives watched with dismay as Henry Cuellar crept ahead of Jessica Cisneros in the vote count. Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez vented her frustration at House leaders for aiding Henry Cuellar, attacking her colleague's policy positions and his potential involvement in an FBI investigation. Cuellar's home and campaign office were raided in January, but the congressman has denied wrongdoing, and his attorney claimed he was not the target of an investigation. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said on Twitter, "On the day of a mass shooting and weeks after news of Roe, Democratic Party leadership rallied for a pro-NRA anti-choice incumbent under investigation in a close primary. Robocalls, fundraisers, all of it." Adding, "Accountability isn't partisan. This was an utter failure of leadership." Progressives see a pattern in how party leaders and centre-left groups are targeting their candidates in primaries. In Pennsylvania's 12th congressional district, super PACs spent millions of dollars trying to prevent the nomination of State Representative Summer Lee, although the progressive lawmaker ultimately won her primary. Democratic Congressman Kurt Schrader, who had attracted criticism for blocking key parts of Joe Biden's agenda, still won the president's endorsement and secured the backing of House Democrats' campaign arm, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. Kurt Schrader officially lost his primary to progressive challenger Jamie McLeod Skinner on Friday, 27th of May. Progressives argue that Jessica Cisneros would have easily cruised to victory as well if the Democratic establishment, particularly House leaders, had not invested so heavily to assist Henry Cuellar. In the weeks leading up to Tuesday's election, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi recorded a robocall for Henry Cuellar, while Majority Whip Jim Clyburn traveled to Texas to campaign alongside his colleague. Waleed Shaheed, communications director for the progressive group Justice Democrats, said, "With a margin this small, it's clear that a pro-choice, anti-NRA Democrat could have easily won if it wasn't for the full-throated support of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and the party establishment in Washington for anti-choice, pro-NRA Henry Cuellar." Waleed Shaheed added, "Why is all of Democratic Party leadership more heavily focused on defeating an anti-NRA, pro-choice Democrat than defeating Republicans in the midterm elections?" But allies of House Leader Nancy Pelosi and Majority Whip Jim Clyburn see nothing nefarious in their actions to help candidates like Henry Cuellar, given that endorsing incumbents has long been a standard practice for party leaders. Antoine Seawright, a Democratic strategist who serves as a senior advisor to the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, claimed House leader's strategy was practical as the party attempts to hold on to its narrow majority in the chamber. Republicans only need to flip a handful of seats to regain control of the House, and they're heavily favored to do so, given historical trends and President Biden's underwater approval rating. Antoine Seawright said, "At the end of the day, it's about 218. That's the number of votes needed on any given day to get anything done. This is all about preserving and keeping the majority." The shifting politics of Henry Cuellar's district also adds more complexity to the race. Texas's 28th congressional district, which covers the eastern outskirts of San Antonio and stretches down to the U.S.-Mexico border, was previously considered a Democratic stronghold. But the district has become more conservative in recent years, and election forecasters consider it to be a toss-up race for November. With a difficult general election ahead, Some Democrats say a more conservative member of the party, like Henry Queller, who has held the seat since 2005, may have a better chance at winning. Antoine Seabright said, "Mr. Queller has been re-elected on many occasions in that district, and I think that means that the voters of that district, Democrats, Republicans and Independents alike, have made the decision that he's a person they want representing their interests in Washington." But supporters of Jessica Cisneros' campaign take issue with that argument. Ezra Olive Lieberman, the electoral organizer in Texas's 28th congressional district for the climate group Sunrise Movement, said Jessica Cisneros would be the stronger candidate in the general election because of her ability to energize and mobilize young voters. Since Sunrise endorsed Cisneros last year, the group has made more than 700,000 calls to support her campaign. Ezra Olive Lieberman said, "We've been knocking doors in 100-degree Texas heat because we're excited about and inspired by the vision that Jessica Cisneros is fighting for that says we don't have to live in fear of gun violence, that we can have freedom to make decisions about our own bodies." Looking ahead to the general election, Ezra Olive Lieberman added, "It's going to be hard and we need a grassroots base to win. And I think Democratic leadership is squandering any hope of us winning by alienating young people." Ezra Olive Lieberman noted that young voters helped elect Joe Biden and secure the party's majorities in Congress. And he accused House Democratic leaders of ignoring the needs of a key constituency. Olive Lieberman said, "It's so abundantly clear what young people want and how Democratic leadership is willing to do the exact opposite. I feel really angry that we have put so much into fighting for a better world and to try to put a stop to so many of the crises that we're facing. And it feels like the people who are standing in the way of that are people who supposedly are on our side." Olive Lieberman and Jessica Cisneros' other supporters have said they will fight to get every vote counted in Texas's 28th congressional district, expressing hope that Henry Queller can still be defeated. But regardless of the outcome in Texas, progressives are encouraged by the victories they have already seen in primaries this year with candidates like Lee and McLeod Skinner. They are ready to keep up the fight, even if Democratic leaders attempt to stand in their way. Ezra Olive Lieberman said, "If anything, I think this primary season so far is just emboldening our movement to build more power, to keep going to get stronger." He added, "And we know that the establishment is scared."
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we try to answer your questions, issues you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. Imam Ali alayhi salam said, acquire knowledge when you're very young, because when you grow up, you're going to be successful and progressful for your society. In this program, we try to give you the tips. We try to give you the information how you can make your children give all that knowledge as young as possible, where you can start up with your children. While on that note, we have with us in our studio today Mr. Salman Akavi, who is a faculty member of Al Mustafa University and an Islamic researcher in the Hafza Almi of Qom. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
It's an honor. Thank you very much.
It's been some time that we talked about the upbringing, the education, the elements of education, the types of education. You discussed with us the domains of behavior and the relationships. I would want you to give a brief of the previous session so that we can start out with the new topic.
Yes, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I begin this talk of mine in the name of Allah, the Supreme Absolute Being. Yes, we talked about the fact that upbringing is actually a form of education.
Yeah.
Even informal education. But still, the elements that are there in formal education are also present in this informal education. The six elements of education which we mentioned,
yeah,
they are there. And then, namely, the starting behavior or the entrance behavior, the exit behavior,
yeah,
the behavior which is expected from a person or from a child.
Yeah.
And then you have the child himself or herself who wants to be taught, who has to be brought up.
Who has to be trained.
Who has to be trained, educated.
Yeah.
So it's he's or she is moving up the ladder.
Yeah.
And then the facilitator of that movement is the teacher, the guide, the mentor, who in this case is basically one of the parents or both of the parents.
Yeah.
And then we have the pathway towards that change, the environment, the strategies which are used, the tactics which are employed. They are all there in the fifth element, that is the path.
Yes.
So the learning environment may be the home itself, inside the home,
yeah,
outside in the society, or as is the case in formal education, it is in the school or the college, or any training center where the child goes.
Yeah.
Or even the gymnasium or the gym or the or any for even sports activities when yeah. The child goes for sports, swimming, all of these are learning environments.
Yeah.
And basically in Islam's point of view, one's whole life is a learning environment.
Yes, the entire life, a person learns from the cradle to grave.
Exactly. I'll be talking and the sixth element is the change which is beneath the surface, which comes without which the apparent change,
mm-hmm,
the overt behavior, which we want to...
The expected behavior. From,
yes, the expected behavior cannot come about unless there's a change within beneath the surface.
Beneath the surface.
And that's the increasing knowledge and the increasing emotional conditions that have to be taught.
That we we expect, actually, from a child.
And the psychomotor skills that he has to learn.
Yeah.
She has to learn to be able to carry out that behavior.
Yes. I will continue the session with you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. And we are talking about Islamic upbringing in children. Dear brother, you said that there are psychomotor skills that parents have to be look upon.
Yes, of course. I mean, for that, if we go into the behavior which is expected you can understand from the classification and the taxonomy of that behavior that I have presented before, and I'm going to go into a little more detail about that,
mm-hmm.
you will very clearly understand where the psychomotor skills come in.
Yeah.
For example, when we are talking about the four relations which we have,
yeah.
which we have to manage in our lives through mm-hmm. proper behavior, whether it is with myself or with my with the society, with other people, or even the environment that I'm living in, and with my Lord Allah Almighty.
Yeah.
All of these require skills.
Skills.
For example, when I'm talking about the relationship which I have with myself.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about that. When I'm talking about the relationship with myself,
okay.
and my father or my mother has to facilitate in that.
Mm-hmm.
That I learn how to manage myself. What are the things I have to manage?
All
basically,
right.
I have the resources, my personal resources, the personal faculties, the inherent faculties in myself.
Okay.
For example, I'm talking about my mental health.
All right.
Or my physical health.
Mm-hmm.
My physiological and physical health, my mental health, which means the intellectual development, the emotional development, which is there within myself.
Yes.
I have to manage that. I have to
take care of that. If anything goes wrong, I should be able to manage everything.
Of course. I mean, I have to manage my mental health.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the parent or the mentor has to tell me how to do that. Guide me. For example, if my father or my mother, even when I was in the womb of
yeah.
the mother, and the mother was engaged in a subject which had theoretical issues
okay.
in it, like mathematics.
Okay.
Even that thinking of my mother, the way she thought about those issues, philosophical, mathematical,
had impact on the baby.
That would have an effect on the child in the womb.
Okay.
She or he would be intellectually developed.
Okay.
And when I come to to this world, and at a proper age, my parents at home start playing with me
mm-hmm.
Mind games.
Okay.
And for example, Scrabble or whatever.
The block games, the Scrabble.
There are so many yeah. mind games, so many books that are talking to
everything
children.
Everything has impact.
Yes.
Okay. So I'll be talking to you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIP English Radio.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the 80th surah of the Holy Quran, Surah Abbas, verse 24 says فَلْيَنْظُرِ الْإِنسَانُ إِلَىٰ طَعَامِ So let man observe his food.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We're talking about the development of psychomotor skills. Yes, brother, you were saying that if parents need to work on the mental development, the emotional development, so that a child develops a good relationship with his own self.
Exactly. He is able to manage. So one of those things were the mental and physical aspects. For example, in the physical aspects, it's about food.
Yeah.
Proper food. Nutrition.
Okay.
Me as a parent, which is going to facilitate that development, know about proper food.
Okay.
Nutrition.
Mm-hmm.
Eating it. What are the proper etiquettes and manners of eating? Okay. How should I eat properly? So these are all psychomotor skills which are involved. One is the knowledge, knowing what type of food is good for my health, for my child's health,
mm-hmm.
Which will help his or her physical development.
A
balanced diet,
yeah.
A balanced diet, proteins and carbohydrates, vitamins, fats,
vitamins,
everything should be balanced.
Okay.
I, as a parent, should know. I should be able to teach my child
mm-hmm.
indirectly that what I'm giving you is a balanced diet. You have to maintain that balanced diet,
okay.
chew it properly, wash your hands before going for food. Eating at a proper at a fixed time in the day,
mm-hmm.
all of these are the proper behavior which we expect from a person, from a Muslim child.
So when we are expecting all those behaviors, parents need to have particular knowledge about each and every step, first of all, and then apply that on the child.
Exactly. I'll talk, there's a research paper done by a professor from Canada, I think, I don't remember his name, but that was done in on a society which is very particular about their children.
Okay.
And that is, during childbirth, before childbirth, during pregnancy, that society, the women were engaged, they had special protocols to follow.
Okay.
They would listen to special music, they would listen to study books,
okay,
especially mathematics.
Mm-hmm.
And today we see, I don't want to name that nation or people, but they are at the top as far as academic excellence goes.
Okay.
So this is very important. And this is what Islam wants to us, when Islam expects us to mothers to recite the Quran during pregnancy.
To be in ablution all the time.
All the time. And taking care of all these protocols.
To recite Adhan and Iqama yourself.
And especially the nutrition, the food, the recreation, the sports, activities, going out into the environment, gardening,
mm-hmm,
allowing the children to play in the mud and all these things. They should not be, at least in the initial 7 years, as it is said, 7 years of
the first 7 years.
The first 7 years, the child is supposed to be the king, a king, yep, or a queen. But that does not mean that he or she is not to be educated or he or she has not to learn anything. Learning has to go on. Education, yeah, and learning has to go on, but not in the formal sense. Yeah. Unfortunately, nowadays, in many
societies, we only think that the education is a formal kind of education,
exactly,
and there's informal.
Many societies I know about, we live in, that children are enlisted and admitted into schools before even they are born.
Yeah.
I mean, some societies are there.
Unfortunately.
And at a very tender age of 2 or 3, they're forced to go to school,
mm-hmm,
with books packed on their backs. And this is not education. This is not upbringing.
So education and upbringing is not pressurizing your child. We must know all those levels and steps which we discuss in our program. And inshallah, we'll discuss again in future. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you so much, dear listeners, for listening to IRIB English Radio. In case you have any questions for us, you have any feedback, please feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can also find us on these social media platforms by just searching Call of Islam Radio. You can also download our programs on our official website. That's www.parstoday.com. Until another session, fi amanullah, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Islam solves all of our problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.